Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
There have been many books written about the assassination of President John Kennedy. My guest today has written what has been called by far the most important book yet written on the subject, and the most thoroughly researched and documented book ever written about President Kennedy's determination to prevent a nuclear war. James Douglas is a longtime peace activist and writer whose newest book is JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. And if you don't mind, I'm going to call you Jim.
That's great, Nancy. Thank
you. Welcome, Jim. And what brought you to Chico?
I was invited by David Leeper Moss, the minister of the Methodist Church here in Chico, and by a community of peace and justice activists, some of whom I've been meeting over the last few hours, and all kinds of others whom I hope to meet in future hours.
Well, we're certainly glad you came and that you have written this book. And it is, I understand that when you first began this book, it's going to cover assassinations of other important figures, and your editor said, hey, wait a minute, you've got too much information here.
Well, precisely what he said is, who's going to have the money to buy this book?
Oh.
Because it would have been thousands of pages long. As it is, this is just the first of three books. We've divided it into a trilogy, and the first is JFK and the Unspeakable. The second will be on Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, Malcolm, Martin, and the Unspeakable. And the final book of the three books will be on Robert Kennedy, RFK, and the Unspeakable.
Well, you have so much documentation in your book that it must have taken you an awfully long time to write this book, to put it together.
About 12 years in the research, about 10 to 9 years in the actual writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it shows, because you have 100 pages worth of endnotes in your book.
Well, a lot of it came from the National Archives, and specifically a huge building in College Park, Maryland, which has literally hundreds of thousands of documents connected with the John F. Kennedy assassination, which have been made public as a result of the JFK Records Act, passed in turn because of the Oliver Stone film, which appealed to people who saw it to go to their members of Congress. They did so, and as a result, it's now a crime to keep private any document related to the assassination of Kennedy.
So we can indirectly thank Oliver Stone for knowing the truth.
For
getting as close to the truth as he can.
For pushing so hard toward the truth as he did that we now have the documentation for what is clearly the truth, and we can talk about what that is.
Well, in the title of your book, JFK and the Unspeakable, where did you get that word? Because I know you chose it deliberately.
The Unspeakable comes from my spiritual guide, a man named Thomas Merton, who in his Raids on the Unspeakable, a great book he wrote in 1965, talks about a kind of evil that goes beyond the power of words to describe. And he was, of course, writing in the midst of the Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and those four assassinations we just mentioned. And he felt that there was something there which he couldn't even touch with words, and that we don't want to touch with words. He's speaking on behalf of all of us. We don't want to go where we don't want to go there, and that's the unspeakable, where we don't want to go. And at the heart of the unspeakable is the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
My guest is James Douglas, and his book is JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. In fact, Thomas Merton had things to say that higher ups didn't want published, so he had to put his words and send them to friends, his Cold War letters.
That's exactly right, and those Cold War letters were published 2 years ago for the first time.
Oh my goodness!
By the same publisher that I have for JFK and the Unspeakable, namely Orbis Books. Mm-hmm. And Merton's letters that he wrote privately and then collected like a little manuscript and sent to friends like such as myself have now finally become public.
In fact, there is a quote that just is burned in anybody, I think, who reads this book. You just can't forget this expression, this sentence that Thomas Merton wrote. Could you read us a little bit of that?
What Merton wrote to a friend in January 62 as Kennedy was entering the second year of his presidency is a very sharp criticism of him with a prophecy. He said, "I have little confidence in Kennedy. What is needed is not shrewdness or craft, but what the politicians don't have, depth, humanity, and a certain totality of self-forgetfulness and compassion, not just for individuals, but for humanity as a whole, a deeper kind of dedication. Maybe Kennedy will break through into that someday by miracle, but such people are before long marked out for assassination."
Yeah, Merton is recognizing that if Kennedy does make the changes that Merton would like for him to make, he becomes the kind of person who's going to be assassinated.
Yes, and the point, I think, at which the miracle that Thomas Merton is calling for happened was at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Or actually, we could say its depth in terms of the unspeakable. Kennedy had reached the point where he felt he had lost control of his national security state, that his Joint Chiefs of Staff, the CIA, his military, and intelligence advisors were pushing so hard for a nuclear war, he could not stop it. And he appealed secretly to Nikita Khrushchev at that point through Robert Kennedy in a meeting with Ambassador Dobrynin in Washington, D.C. He appealed for help. He said, I can't do it myself at this point. I can't get out of the situation in which, of course, he had helped put himself, but which his advisors were pushing beyond any point that Kennedy wanted, and trying to invade Cuba to destroy the missiles there and then to strike the Soviet Union with a nuclear attack. And when Khrushchev received that message that JFK through RFK was appealing to him for help, he turned in Moscow to his foreign minister, Andrei Gromyko, and he said, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." And Gromyko couldn't believe what he was hearing. And
here's our enemy offering to help our president.
Our enemy. So Khrushchev himself could hardly believe what he was saying. So he repeated it and he added a sentence. He said, "Yes, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. We now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war." And that is the turning point, that moment, a turning point for all of us, for all of humanity, because we were on the verge where the Soviets had just knocked down a U-2 spy plane over
Here
Cuba.
We were
on the verge of total nuclear war. And at that point, Kennedy's appeal to Khrushchev, kind of bottoming out like an alcoholic at the bottom of that process, Kennedy's bottoming out from nuclear war, and he said, "I need your help." Khrushchev says, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." And then he, of course, made a public announcement immediately that he was withdrawing his missiles from Cuba. And Kennedy pledged never to invade Cuba, and he pledged secretly to pull our missiles out of the border to the Soviet Union from Turkey. And that tit-for-tat alarmed and alienated the national security states on both sides. So Kennedy at that point became closer to Khrushchev than either were to their own national security states.
James Douglas has written JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Now, you mentioned these missiles that were pointed right at the Soviet Union, and I think Americans think, well, golly, those mean Russians, they came into Cuba and put missiles up and we didn't do anything. And don't realize that the Soviet Union was reacting to the fact that we had missiles pointed at them in Turkey.
Yes, they were just responding to a situation where we had already done what they were trying to do. They were, of course, also responding to the fact that in the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban exiles had already invaded Cuba with the very necessary support of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the missiles were designed to deter that happening again. But Kennedy had felt that in the Bay of Pigs, the previous event, that he had been manipulated into doing that by the CIA. So after it happened, he said, "I want to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds."
And this is another sentence in your book that kept coming back in my own mind, how many times I thought of that sentence, that Kennedy recognized the problem that CIA was and said he would like to shatter it and scatter it to the winds. And you mentioned in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, let's put a name on one of these characters that in the movie Dr. Strangelove, this character was not mentioned by name, but those of us who remember that movie know that it was Curtis LeMay, General LeMay,
yes,
who was portrayed in that movie, Dr. Strangelove. And Curtis LeMay is just, he amazes me in the, when the missile crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev have gotten together, have trusted each other, the missile crisis is over, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, instead of being congratulating him, saying, "This is a wonderful thing you did," he said, We lost. He was angry.
We lost, yes. And the Joint Chiefs, when they went into Kennedy's office right after, they were furious. In the midst of the missile crisis, as you recall, I cited JFK taped all those conversations, so we know everything that was said in the key meetings in the missile crisis. And LeMay, at the key point in the missile crisis, he says this blockade of Kennedy's and political action, he's talking to JFK himself in a small meeting, just the Joint Chiefs and him. He says to Kennedy, "This blockade and political action is almost as bad as the appeasement of Hitler at Munich." And he says, "I'm sure that a lot of our friends and neutrals would see this as being a pretty weak response. You're in a pretty bad fix, Mr. President." So Kennedy responds to him, "What did you say?" And LeMay says, "You're in a pretty bad fix." And President Kennedy says, with a kind of mocking laugh, he says, "You're in with me." And then as he walks out of the office, he leaves the tape recording, and LeMay and another general are talking about the president, and one of the other generals says what we've got to do is go in and get every goddamn one, every missile, escalation, that's it. Somebody's got to keep them, meaning JFK, from doing the goddamn thing piecemeal. That's our problem. They want to go in and destroy Cuba and the Soviet Union, and when JFK doesn't do it, he's regarded as a traitor.
Yeah. Well, one thing that there are a lot of times when President Kennedy's humor comes out, and one of the times is after this meeting, and he tells one of his aides, "Can you imagine LeMay saying a thing like that? These brass hats have one great advantage in their favor. If we listen to them and do what they want us to do, none of us will be alive later to tell them that they were wrong."
Oh, yes, yes.
On this anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, James Douglas has written a book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Well, so Kennedy then is finding an ally really in Khrushchev, and enemies within his own staff. And it just as I was reading this book, in my own mind, the guys that wore the black hats in my memory,
yes,
were trading them off, and they were now wearing the white hats.
That's,
I mean, we
right.
have this, a lot of us who remember Khrushchev,
yes,
pounding with his shoe on the podium, and
right,
this, he's the bad guy wearing the black hat. And we find out that, no, Khrushchev is willing to trust. He doesn't say we don't have differences, but he's willing to trust Kennedy. And Castro, too. Has been vilified, and I see that he really wants to. And isn't it interesting that our own language, we don't have the words, we have to go to French for words like détente and rapprochement?
That's right.
That we don't even have the words in our language.
And Khrushchev, in the half year beyond the Cuban Missile Crisis, he realized that Castro was furious with him because Khrushchev had withdrawn the missiles without consulting with Castro. And so Khrushchev, in order to solve the breach between him and Castro, he invited him over to the Soviet Union. And Castro spent a month touring with Khrushchev. And what Khrushchev did during that month was day after day after day, he read to him the secret correspondence between John F. Kennedy and himself, pounding the table, saying, "You've got to trust this man. Uh-huh. You've got to trust this man." That's the key to resolving the situation now. And so by the time that John F. Kennedy secretly contacted Fidel Castro in September 1963, 2 months before his assassination, to begin a dialogue with him, Castro was ready, and he said, "Yes, I want a dialogue with you, JFK." And that's another reason for the assassination. They were beginning to dialogue to normalize relations between Cuba and the United States, which hasn't happened to this day. And they were doing it at the height of the Cold War.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's skip ahead then to another character that has been wearing a black hat was Lee Harvey Oswald.
That's right.
And we find out things that maybe, just maybe, he foiled a plot in Chicago kill Kennedy in Chicago.
In Chicago on November 2, 1963, 20 days before Dallas, JFK was scheduled to attend an Army Air Force football game. And there was a plot to kill him. And the Secret Service was alerted by a whistleblower, an unidentified person named Lee, L-E-E. And as a result of that whistleblower's help, and actually there was another whistleblower as well, they the Secret Service arrested a sniper team in Chicago that was planning to kill Kennedy on a route to the Air Force, Army Air Force game. And along that route was a man named Thomas Arthur Valley, an ex-Marine, of course. Lee Harvey Oswald was an ex-Marine who worked at a CIA base in Japan. Lee Harvey Oswald had worked at the CIA base in Japan, who had helped to train Cuban exiles to assassinate Castro. Well, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald had done that too, although we aren't well acquainted with that fact. The man had exactly the same background. He was a CIA operative, as Lee Harvey Oswald was, and the plot was foiled in Chicago, and Thomas Arthur Valley did not become the scapegoat in a building exactly over the motorcade, just as Oswald's building was over the motorcade in Dallas. And thanks to the whistleblowing of a man named Lee, I think that was Lee Harvey Oswald. Mm-hmm.
So he not only saved Kennedy, but saved this other poor guy who was going to take the fall.
He saved the previous scapegoat, and we wouldn't know the name Lee Harvey Oswald if the plot had gone through in Chicago. Mm-hmm. We would know Thomas Arthur Valley as the assassin.
Yeah. So there are so many interesting details that you bring out in this whole episode of what happens in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963. But then after it happens, Castro begins asking questions that our own media, that nobody here in the States seemed to be asking. And this, what were some of those questions that occurred to Castro?
Well, Fidel Castro gave an extraordinary speech on the day after the assassination. And all he did was read to the Cuban people wire service reports that came out minutes after the assassination itself, describing the assassin right after the assassination, and telling the background of Lee Harvey Oswald. And these are some of the questions. I'll cite from his speech. We don't know this speech to this day. And he said things like, "How strange it is that the assassination of President Kennedy should take place at a time when there was unanimous agreement of opinion against certain aspects of his policy. How strange all this is." That's the policies that we were just talking about, that he's beginning to resolve issues with the Soviet Union. And then he said about Oswald, can anyone who has said that he will disclose military secrets, as Oswald said to the Soviet Union when he so-called defected to the Soviet Union for 2 years, Can such a man return to the United States without being sent to jail? How strange that this former Marine should go to the Soviet Union and try to become a Soviet citizen, and that the Soviets should not accept him, that he should say at the American embassy that he intended to disclose to the Soviet Union the secrets of everything he learned while he was in the U.S. service as a Marine, and that in spite of this statement, his passage is paid by the U.S. government to a traitor. He goes back to Texas and finds a job. This is all so strange. Yes, it is strange indeed. Castro, just looking at these wire service reports, could see CIA written all over the face of Lee Harvey Oswald, because, of course, he knew assassination plots intimately.
Oh, yeah.
In his own context.
In fact, it's rather funny. Well, I don't know if funny, but one way the CIA was going to assassinate Castro was to get an innocent person to offer him a gift of, of a wetsuit that was contaminated.
And Fidel Castro had an increasing appreciation of Kennedy, thanks to Khrushchev, and thanks also to Kennedy's attempts to dialogue with him. At the time that JFK died, Fidel Castro was having lunch with JFK's intermediary, a man named Jean Daniel, a French reporter who had just met with JFK in Washington. JFK raised with him a series of questions to raise with Fidel. And so while Fidel is having lunch with this man who is raising those questions with him, and Fidel is saying how much he is beginning to appreciate Kennedy, then he learns via phone call at that very moment that JFK has been assassinated. And then he stands up and he looks at Danielle and he says, everything has changed. Everything is going to change. Mm-hmm. And it did. And years later, when members of Congress went down and met with Fidel on the question of the assassination, Fidel said to them, one of the characteristics of Kennedy was courage. He was a courageous man, a man capable of taking a decision one way or another, a man capable of revising a policy because he had the courage to do so. And then he said to these members of Congress, I can tell you that in the period in which Kennedy's assassination took place, Kennedy was changing his policy toward Cuba. To a certain extent, we were honored in having such a rival. He was an outstanding man.
My guest is James Douglas. He has written a book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. He refers to John Kennedy as being courageous, and this comes up a lot of times, and you realize as the reader of your book how what courage it took for Kennedy to say the things and make the decisions that he did. He felt an identification, I think, with Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, he did.
One of his favorite sayings of Lincoln was, I know there is a God, and I see a storm coming. If he has a place for me, I believe that I am ready. And so he was willing to tackle. He had the courage to tackle these overwhelming obstacles that were put in his path. In fact, one thing that was almost funny was after he and his brother, Robert Kennedy, were talking, and after the missile crisis was over, and JFK told his brother, this is the night I should go to the theater. And then his brother replies, if you go, I want to go with you.
Yes, and they would both go soon.
Yeah. Well, you have a lot of information in your book that I think will inspire us as readers to examine our own actions. And we might think there isn't much that we can do, but you do have some suggestions when you are writing about the courage that Kennedy had and what we might do today, because everything you said in this book that was taking place at that time could apply today.
One thing to remember, just a tiny point, is that when Barack Obama was endorsed by Caroline and Ted Kennedy, that occurred at a place called the American University. Now, I haven't spoken about the American University yet, but just so people will know, the center of this book is John F. Kennedy's American University Address on June 10, 1963, which is to his assassination, just as Martin Luther King's April 4, 1968 mm-hmm. address at the Riverside Church is to his assassination. It's the reason. It's the reason why. And for Caroline and Ted Kennedy to endorse Obama at American University means that they are hoping that the vision of disarmament and peace that Kennedy articulated at American University and died for is what Obama mm-hmm. will stand for, and for that matter, be ready to die for also.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
pretty much to the point.
And this American University speech is reproduced in your book, the full text
word
of that
for
speech.
Word for word, and it's analyzed in page after page.
And could we go back to and mention who inspired Kennedy on this subject? Was a dying pope.
Pope John the 23rd. He was the unofficial, and I underline that, very real spiritual advisor of Nikita Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy, the first person to receive a copy of Pacem in Terris, the Pope's great encyclical, his great letter to the world, was Nikita Khrushchev. It was given to him, translated into Russian by Norman Cousins, who was the go-between among the three of them, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Pope John the 23rd. So Pope John the 23rd lies behind a lot of this incredible miracle that Merton was praying for and that happened between Kennedy and Khrushchev.
Yeah, and that speech is just an amazing speech that was more fully appreciated outside the United States. It was practically ignored here in our country.
And to this day, hardly anybody knows about it. It's by far Kennedy's most significant speech, which caused his death. Mm-hmm. And it was printed on the front pages of all the Soviet newspapers. It was heard on all the radio and TV stations because Khrushchev put it on all of them. And in the United States, it was ignored and downplayed and critiqued by the New York Times that said the people in Washington saw little chance that Kennedy's initiatives for peace would get a positive response. In fact, Nikita Khrushchev called it the greatest speech by any American president since Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Yeah, and a lot of people were saying this was impossible, which reminded me of what the Pope would say.
Anything is possible.
Anything
is possible.
Possible
is what, as I cited from Norman Cousins, one of his meetings with the Pope kept saying, anything is possible. And by that, he meant a world disarmed and at peace. But of course, Kennedy's enemies thought anything is possible too, meaning mm-hmm. the assassination of a president of the United States by his own national security state, which is what happened.
And that's a really difficult truth for those of us as Americans to swallow, I think. As I lived in a third world country for a year, and I think of coup d'etat as something that happens only in third world countries. And to realize that this happened in my own country is just a hard pill to swallow.
That's the unspeakable.
Yeah.
But we do have to speak it. And unless we do, anyone who goes into the same position as Kennedy by trying to create a disarmed world will have the same experience. And
well, would you just, as we are able to conclude, and we've been talking about JFK and the unspeakable, why he died and why it matters with author James Douglas, and at the funeral of John Kennedy, we are given a charge to what?
To do what Jacqueline Kennedy said to McCoyan, Khrushchev's representative. She said, "My husband's dead. Now peace is up to you." And that essence of her message is appropriate to us all. John F. Kennedy is dead. Now peace is up to us.
Peace is up to us. Thank you, Jim. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.